Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are very pleased to have with us Dr. Alexander Kolesov today. He is a referendaire for the Bulgarian judge in the Court of Justice. He has a law degree from the University of Sofia, an LLM from the College of Europe in Bruges, and a PhD from the Academy of Science in Bulgaria. He has great practical experience in EU law and trade law as a former member of the Brussels Bar, and since 2007 has now been an active referendaire at the Court of Justice. Welcome, Alexander, and we're looking forward to your talk.
Thank you. I should probably start with the usual disclaimer that the views expressed today are my personal views, so don't take it as the official view of the European Court of Justice, none of that. Now, the question of the forthcoming EU accession to the European Convention of Human Rights, as we all know, is no longer open for discussion. So the question of whether and why the EU should or should not accede to the convention has been already decided. The chapter is closed, as we know, with the entry into force of the Treaty of Lisbon. Article 6, paragraph 2 of the Treaty on the European Union now provides that the European Union shall accede to the European Convention of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms. Nonetheless, the question of on what terms, on what conditions the EU should accede to the convention is still very much an open issue. The forthcoming EU accession to the ECHR, a myriad of problems, few solutions. This is the topic of my presentation. And I have to confess that this is actually the least pessimistic title that I could come up with. The more I look into the issue, the more I dig into it, the more it looks like a real conundrum. A myriad of problems indeed start popping up immediately, while, unfortunately, very few solutions seem to be immediately apparent. Since we are a little bit short on time today, I would unfortunately not be able to talk about all these different problems that have so far been identified. I will focus my presentation first on the impact of the forthcoming accession to the ECHR, and specifically on the EU area of freedom, security, and justice. Why? Because this is a problem which so far has been, in my humble opinion, largely neglected. We already have a draft agreement, as you probably know, which was published online almost a year ago. Then the negotiations were blocked for some time. Now, as far as I know, they've been recently reopened. And this problem, the impact on the EU area of freedom, security, and justice has not been addressed in the draft agreement. And even if I could allow myself to say that, even in academic writing. And if we have time, I would also like to look into the two other problems, which, by contrast, have been discussed very much in detail, and some solutions have been already put forward in the draft agreement. And in particular, the question of the division of powers between the EU and its member states and the danger of the court in Strasbourg of possibly ruling on the question. And the third question is the so-called prior involvement of the European Court of Justice. Now, the area of freedom, security, and justice in the EU, this is the first problem that I was going to, that I'm going to talk about, is a strange mixture of different areas of law. Here we have judicial cooperation, civil matters. Also, we have recognition and enforcement of judgments in patrimony concerning parental responsibility. We have judicial cooperation in criminal matters. We have the common asylum European system. We also have questions of immigration, visa, border control. So what do these areas of law have in common? From an EU perspective, there is one underlying principle which brings those different areas of law together, and this is the principle of mutual recognition and mutual trust. The idea of this area is to have a free movement of judgments within the EU. And these are not just hollow shells which have been created in the vacuum of Brussels or of Luxembourg. They have some very important practical consequences. And these practical consequences are the following. First of all, in principle, an EU member state should recognize and enforce a judgment given in another EU member state as if it were its own judgment. There is a general prohibition of a review of the substance of the case. The procedures for recognition and enforcement are quasi-automatic. While the secondary EU legislation does provide for specific grounds for non-recognition, these grounds and non-enforceability, these grounds are very strictly worded. They're very few, and they're also far between. So in other words, the principle of mutual recognition and mutual trust is the sacrosanct pillar of the EU area of freedom, security, and justice, which by definition should not be questioned or scrutinized or called into doubt. Now, those principles of mutual recognition and mutual trust have been enshrined in primary law. You can look at Article 67, 81, and 82 of the Treaty of Lisbon. The Court of Justice, since the entry into force of the Treaty of Lisbon, the area of freedom, security, of freedom, security, and justice has become, in my opinion, the favorite child of the Luxembourg Court. While before the entry into force of the Treaty of Lisbon, the competence of the ECJ was somewhat restricted. With the entry into force of the Treaty of Lisbon, the ECJ has acquired practically competence on the almost entire area of freedom, security, and justice. And it has even developed a new urgent preliminary procedure, which has been specifically dedicated to this area of law. And in its case law, as we'll see in a minute, those two principles have been really the guiding light of its case law on the area of freedom, security, and justice. On the other hand, however, and this is where the question of the ECHR comes into this presentation, is the question of the respect of fundamental rights. Of course, since the Treaty of Lisbon, we all know we have the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, which has binding force. And the idea of mutual recognition and mutual trust in the EU is that EU member states are regarded as respecting fundamental rights. This is the very idea of mutual trust and mutual recognition. So the question, the very practical question, is whether a member state can invoke as a ground of non-recognition of a judgment or an extrajudicial decision rendered in another member state, can it invoke an alleged violation of fundamental rights as a ground for non-recognition and non-enforceability? There is one way to try to strike the right balance between mutual recognition and respect for human rights in the European Union, and this is very much seen in the case law of the ECJ so far, and this is by setting up some kind of a presumption. According to this presumption, EU member states are presumed, they're assumed to respect fundamental rights, because otherwise we wouldn't have mutual recognition or mutual trust. However, this presumption, of course, is a rebuttable presumption. So if, in a given case, you were to be able to show that, to adduce sufficient evidence that fundamental rights have been breached, then in that case, probably we'll see a bit later, probably you would be able to oppose the recognition or enforcement of judgments rendered in another EU member state. The problem with the forthcoming EU accession to the ECHR is that the Convention on Human Rights, to put it simply, does not give much consideration to the principle of mutual recognition and mutual trust. The only thing the court in Strasbourg is worried about, is concerned about, is this only one part of the equation, fundamental rights. Whereas, as we saw, the ECJ also takes into consideration, even as a starting point, the principle of mutual recognition and tries to strike a balance between the two. Let me give you some examples. The first example is from the area of application of the so-called Brussels I regulation, recognition and enforcement of judgments in civil and commercial matters. As I said, the Brussels I regulation is based on the automatic or quasi-automatic recognition of judgments in civil matters and commercial matters. There are, as I said, specific grounds for non-recognition, and for the purposes of my presentation today, of relevance is Article 34, paragraph 1, which provides that recognition may be refused if it is, I quote, manifestly contrary to public policy. Now, the Brussels I regulation does not provide for a general ground for non-recognition on the basis of an alleged violation of fundamental rights. There is no such ground for non-recognition. So therefore, under the Brussels I regulation, you could possibly try to oppose the recognition and enforcement of a foreign judgment only as far as the alleged violation of fundamental rights comes within the scope of this manifest breach or contrary to public policy. How has the ECJ interpreted this in its case law? For example, in its judgments in the cases Krombach and Apostolidis, the court ruled that Article 34, paragraph 1 of the regulation must be interpreted strictly inasmuch as it constitutes an obstacle to the attainment of one of the fundamental objectives of that regulation, which is mutual recognition. Then it went on to say that Article 31, paragraph 1, may be relied only in exceptional cases. And furthermore, I quote, this is very interesting, and this has become a constant case law of the ECJ, recourse to the public policy proviso can be envisaged only where recognition or enforcement of the judgment given in another member state would be at variance to an unacceptable degree with the legal order of the state. Further on, the infringement would have to constitute a manifest breach of an essential rule of law. And the court ended its analysis by recalling that the system of legal remedies in each member state must be considered as affording a sufficient guarantee to individuals. From those judgments, I think it is clear that the ECJ set up what I call a specific, a sui generis presumption, according to which member states do respect fundamental rights. However, as I said, this presumption is rebuttable, but the bar has been put rather high, as we just saw. You will have to show that there is a manifest breach of a fundamental right, which clashes to an unacceptable degree with the executing member state's legal order. How would that change from the perspective of the European Court of Human Rights? What would be its analysis? First of all, as we all know, there is the famous Bosphorus presumption of the European Court of Human Rights, and I will just very briefly recall what it was all about. This was a case about a Yugoslav aircraft, which was impounded in Ireland because there was a council regulation at the time which imposed an embargo on Yugoslavia during the war there. And according to this embargo, whatever you have a property of Yugoslav enterprise or of the Yugoslav government in one of the member states are obliged under EU law to seize it. Now, Ireland, in its defense, the case was brought against Ireland. Ireland, in its defense, said, well, listen, this breach, it was not attributable to me. It was not my fault, even if, assuming there was a breach of fundamental rights. It was not my fault, it was the fault of the EU, and I was merely acting under EU law. I had no margin of discretion whatsoever. In this case, the European Court of Human Rights said, well, we accept that argument, we look at the EU legal order, we come to the conclusion that protection of fundamental rights in the EU legal order is equivalent to that provided or ensured by the convention. And therefore, as long as this remains the case, the European Court of Human Rights will not review the compatibility of member states' action under EU law with convention rights. Now, the question is, after accession, would that presumption would still be applicable? We can only guess, but my guess is that it will not be applicable anymore, because in the first place, it was justified by the fact that the European Union was not a party at the convention at the time. So therefore, once you join the convention, there was no longer justification for you being treated differently, because such a presumption is not applicable to any other contracting state to the convention. Secondly, the Bosphorus presumption, even if it were to be applied after EU accession, is applicable only where EU member states had no margin of discretion whatsoever. So they were implementing EU law as such. They didn't have any leeway under EU law. Now, under the Brussels I regulation, and we'll see further on, under the almost the entire EU area of freedom, security, and justice, member states, at least according to the European Court of Human Rights, do have some margin of discretion. Why? Because as I mentioned earlier, there are certain grounds for non-recognition and for non-enforceability. It's true that according to the ECJ, these grounds are to be interpreted and applied very restrictively. Still, there are those grounds. And we'll see later on in the MSS case that indeed, because there was this possibility of member states derogating in a way from EU law, that the court in Strasbourg reached the conclusion that the Bosphorus doctrine, the Bosphorus presumption, was not applicable. So therefore, in a typical Brussels I regulation, we can come to the conclusion that the court in Strasbourg would most probably look into every individual allegation of a breach of fundamental rights, probably disregarding the principles of mutual recognition and mutual trust. Secondly, I would look at recognition and enforcement of judgment in matters of parental responsibility, the Brussels II bis regulation, and here we have some very interesting examples. Now, the Brussels II bis regulation is based more or less on the same principles as the Brussels I regulation. However, there was a very interesting mechanism under the Brussels II bis regulation, which concerns, in particular, the wrongful removal or retention of a child. In this case, under the Brussels II bis regulation, the jurisdiction, the court, which has jurisdiction as to the substance, i.e., which parent should have parental responsibility or custody over the child, is, by definition, the jurisdiction of the courts of the member state where the child was habitually resident immediately before removal. This is the golden rule of the Brussels II bis regulation. Yes, indeed, the member state to which the child was abducted could oppose the return of the child in very specific and duly justified cases. This is possible. But, and here it becomes extremely interesting, but under Article 11, Paragraph 8 of the regulation, read in conjunction with Article 41 and 42 of this regulation, a decision of non-return handed down by the member state to which the child was abducted can be replaced, if you want, trumped, by a subsequent decision of the member state of the habitual residence of the child before its abduction. And if you have such a second decision of return, if you wish, this decision is automatically enforceable. There are absolutely no grounds for non-recognition or non-enforceability. And this was stated very clearly by the ECJ in its recent case law, and in particular in the cases Rinau and Pofse. This kind of mechanism enjoys procedural autonomy, and the court underlined that there are the grounds for non-recognition and non-enforcement, as I said, are not applicable in this case. In other cases, such as Detičec, for example, we have had also arguments as to the return of the child to the member state where it had its habitual residence before its wrongful removal would be detrimental to it. It will suffer. The child will be exposed to stress, etc., etc. The ECJ was remarkably unimpressed by such arguments. And the rationale behind it was, on the one hand, the ECJ underlined, stressed, yes, indeed, fundamental rights, the best interests of the child, the rights of the parents are extremely important. But these have to be taken into account and balanced by the by the courts of the member state where the child was habitually resident before its wrongful removal. This is a question of substance. It is not that we ignore fundamental rights under EU law. It is a question, however, of who has the jurisdiction to rule on the question. Therefore, the court said, such questions should be examined and assessed, as I said, by the court where the child had its habitual residence before its abduction. Now, the European Court of Human Rights recently handed down a very interesting judgment in the case Snare Zone in Campanella versus Italy, and this case was exactly what happened in Rinau, Pofse, and other cases which the ECJ had looked at previously. The child was abducted from Italy to Latvia by his mother. There was a Latvian court who handed down the decision of no return, and under Article 18, 41, and 42, the Italian court handed down a subsequent decision of return, which, as I said, has to be automatically enforced in Latvia. The European Court of Human Rights basically found a breach of Article 8 of the Convention, ruling that Italy had not sufficiently considered the adverse consequences of the child's return to Italy. There were concerns about the fact that the child didn't speak Italian at the time, that there were not enough the conditions there for its reception were not put into place, etc., etc. Now, the interesting thing about this case is, yes, on the one hand, it was a case only against Italy. But the same considerations would apply if the case was brought also against Latvia, because as we saw, Latvia under EU law was obliged, it had to return the child in that case. So the question is whether Latvia would be held responsible under the convention. As you can see, the EU member states in such a case would be put in a very delicate situation. On the one hand, if they order the return of the child, they would respect their obligations under the Brussels II-bis regulation and under EU law, but they would run the risk of infringing the convention. And conversely, if they refuse in that case to return the child, they would probably say, okay, now I'm not infringing the convention, but they would run the risk of infringing EU law and possibly have an infringement procedure against them under Article 258. The common European asylum system, another very interesting example. The Dublin II regulation, as we know, establishes criteria and mechanisms for determining the member state responsible for examining the asylum application. The key rule of this regulation, as we all know, is the so-called criterion of first entry, which means basically that if an asylum seeker arrives in the UK and it can be proved that he entered the European Union via Bulgaria, let's say, or Estonia, then the UK has the right to return the asylum seeker to that country, and that country would be responsible for examining the application for asylum. The Dublin II regulation also provides for the so-called sovereignty clause. This is Article 3.2, according to which, even if the member state where the application is lodged is not the responsible member state under the criteria of the Dublin II regulation, it can nonetheless take the application and examine it itself, if it wishes to do that. There's a big margin of discretion under the so-called sovereignty clause. Now, the case was brought. I also have to mention that under the Dublin II regulation, under Protocol 24, which is also annexed to the treaties, all member states are considered as safe countries for third country nationals, which is also a specific expression of the principle of mutual recognition and mutual trust. The European Court of Justice was the question of whether a EU member state should refuse to send an asylum seeker to the first EU member state where he entered the EU was brought to the ECJ very recently in the famous NS case. This case was actually on a preliminary reference by a UK court, and it concerned an Afghan national who had entered the EU via Greece. And indeed, there was information that the conditions for receiving asylum seekers in Greece were not particularly favorable to asylum seekers. I'm trying to be diplomatic here. So basically, the question was, can we invoke fundamental rights? Or said the fear that the asylum seeker's fundamental rights would eventually be breached if we return him to Greece, although Greece is considered to be a safe country, as a ground for the UK authorities to examine his or her application. The court, the ECJ, started by saying that it must be assumed that the treatment of asylum seekers in all member states complies with the requirements of the Charter and of the ECHR. However, the court said, it is not inconceivable that that system may, in practice, experience major operational problems in a given member state. Nevertheless, this possibility cannot lead to the conclusion that any infringement of a fundamental right by the member state responsible will affect the obligations of the member state under the Dublin II regulation. Otherwise, and this is, I think, the most interesting part of the judgment, otherwise, the raison d'être of the European Union and the creation of an area of freedom, security, and justice, and in particular the common European asylum system, based on mutual confidence and a presumption of compliance by other member states with European Union law, and in particular with fundamental rights, will be called into question. The court reached the conclusion, however, that the member states where asylum is claimed should refuse to send back the asylum seeker to the member state responsible under the Dublin regulation, where they cannot be unaware that systemic deficiencies in the asylum procedure and in the reception conditions of asylum seekers amount to substantial grounds for believing that the asylum seeker would face a real risk of being subjected to inhuman or degrading treatment with the meaning of Article 4 of the Charter. In that case, the ECJ found that there were such systemic deficiencies in Greece and therefore reached the conclusion that the UK should examine the application itself. Apparently, here again, the court set up a rebuttable presumption, and again, the bar for rebutting this presumption was set up very high. What is interesting here is that the court, the ECJ, for the first time said that not any infringement, or in other words, minor infringements of fundamental rights, would not suffice to disregard the criteria under the Dublin regulation. To the contrary, what you need to show is that there are systemic flaws in the procedure and the reception conditions of asylum seekers. Only 11 months earlier, the European Court of Human Rights had to examine basically the same question. This time it was about, again, Afghan nationals who had managed to reach Belgium, and Belgium had decided to send them back again to Greece. The ECHR reached the same conclusion that both Greece and Belgium breached the ECHR, the convention, because what is interesting here is not so much the breach committed by Greece, but the breach committed by Belgium. Belgium was actually found to breach Article 3 of the convention by the simple fact of sending back the asylum seeker to Greece, because by doing this, it exposed the asylum seeker to the risk of being treated inhumanly. The funny thing is that both these judgments, on the one hand, the NS judgment of the ECJ, and on the other hand, the MSS judgment given by the European Court of Human Rights, were widely hailed for reaching the same conclusion, as if the ECJ and the European Court of Human Rights more or less took the same path, and EU law on the one hand and the European Convention of Human Rights on the other hand can live happily together ever after. However, if we read more carefully the judgment of the ECHR, we'll see that there are at least two major differences, which, as we know, lawyers, sometimes actually the path, the reasoning that you take to arrive at a conclusion is actually more important than the conclusion itself. Firstly, the European Court of Human Rights said that it has to look at the particular situation of the person concerned. And this is very much in line with the case law, with the constant case law of the European Court of Human Rights. In other terms, how the system itself in a given member state works is not a relevant issue in Strasbourg. Second, here the European Court of Human Rights explicitly refused to apply the Bosphorus presumption. It was asked to do so, and it explicitly refused to do so because it said that under the Dublin Regulation, Belgium had the right not to send back the asylum seeker to Greece, in particular under the Sovereignty Clause. Now, until that judgment, the Sovereignty Clause was very rarely used in practice. It was an exception. It was some kind of a diplomatic clause which provided member states with opportunities in politically sensitive cases, for example, to examine the asylum application themselves. Now, after the judgment in MSS, what we basically have here is that the Sovereignty Clause may be converted actually from an exception to a rule, because every time now that an allegation for a possible infringement of fundamental rights is raised in the EU, then member states would have to basically assess whether they should themselves examine the application under the Sovereignty Clause. So again, comparing the two judgments, what we have in the NSECJ's judgment, we have a presumption which is rebuttable. In the ECHR judgment, there is no presumption whatsoever. Second, in the ECJ's judgment, we have the test for rebutting the presumption set very high. We need to show systemic deficiencies. Under the judgment of the ECHR, there is no such requirement. Further on, as I said, don't get me wrong, the Dublin system is not, actually it is far from flawless, and it has to be reformed. And I think we all have to agree with that. But I personally do not agree that reforming the Dublin system means that the very principles on which the common asylum system is built upon, which is mutual trust and mutual recognition, should be called into question themselves. Now, having these examples at hand, I would move on and look at two other problems which have been discussed so far quite into detail by both academic writing and already in the draft agreement. The first problem is the danger of having the Strasbourg Court rule on the question of division of powers between the European Union on one hand and the member states on the other hand. Why do we have this danger? Because actually by choosing the defendant in a complaint, in a case brought before the Strasbourg Court, the complainant may force the ECHR to rule on whether the breach was committed by the EU itself or by its member states. For example, let's imagine the MSS case was brought against the EU only and not against Greece and Belgium. Then the EU in its defense can say, well, listen, the alleged breach was not attributable to me because the member states could refuse to send back the asylum seeker under the Sovereignty Clause. In that case, in order to assess whether the breach was committed or not by the defendant, the European Court of Human Rights will have to look into the question of competence. Who is competent for what? Do member states have a margin of discretion under EU law or not? And this question is a very delicate question, and the ECJ has already ruled in very clear terms, notably in opinion 191, the EFTA agreement, that only the ECJ has the exclusive competence to rule on the question of the division of powers between the EU and its member states, because otherwise the autonomous character of the EU legal order would be put into danger. Now, if we look at the draft agreement, the solutions proposed are the following. On the one hand, the EU can be allowed to so-called intervene into a case which is brought only against member states as a co-respondent. This is Article 3.2 of the draft agreement. However, the co-respondent mechanism is different if it is a member state which wants to intervene as a co-respondent. In that case, this is Article 3, Paragraph 3, member states are allowed to intervene only when there is a question of whether primary EU law is compatible with the convention rights. There are at least four problems that I am able to identify with the draft agreement so far, as it is worded. The first problem is that the correspondent mechanism is voluntary. In other words, it is up to the EU or up to the member state to lodge an application to be constituted as a correspondent. So therefore, me as a defendant, for example, I do not have an interest of intervening because I risk the danger of being of losing the case and having to pay the damages. Nonetheless, even if we assume that the EU and its member states would take this responsibility seriously and would, as a question of principle, intervene every time that the question of division of powers is raised, then you have the problem of the fact that the correspondent mechanism as it stands today is not automatic, meaning that the European Court of Human Rights has the final say. In other terms, you apply for being constituted as a correspondent, but it is up to the European Court of Human Rights to decide whether to admit you in the case, in the procedure, or not. Therefore, the European Court of Human Rights would still be able to look whether it was the member state's responsibility or the responsibility of the European Union in that case. Then again, if we look at the member state's possibility to step into the proceedings as a correspondent, as I mentioned, it is only limited to cases where the compatibility of primary EU law is put into question. Therefore, in a case like MSS, where there was a problem with the Dublin regulation, or even in a case like Campanella versus Italy, where there was a problem with the Brussels Tubis regulation, member states would apparently not be able to intervene. And one last issue before moving to the last problem. It's not the last problem, but the last problem I'm going to talk about is what happens afterwards. Imagine you have a case where the EU, both the EU and the member states, which have been co-defendants in the case, have been found to be in violation of the ECHR, and therefore damages have been awarded. I am unaware of a mechanism under EU law of deciding afterwards who is to bear the financial burden of those damages. Of course, here we're talking damages under the ECHR, and we're not talking about huge financial burdens, but sometimes, indeed, it's a question of principle. So at the time being, I'm personally unaware of how this problem is going to be solved. The question of the prior involvement of the ECJ is the last thing I'm going to talk about before giving you some time to ask me questions. As we know, under Article 35 of the Convention, there is the rule of the so-called exhaustion rule, according to which, in order for your application before the Strasbourg Court to be admissible, you need to show that you have exhausted all possible available domestic remedies. The question is that where you have the question of the compatibility of an EU rule with convention rights, and the question had been brought before a national court, and this national court had not referred a preliminary reference, preliminary reference to the ECJ. The question is of whether, in that case, the exhaustion rule would mean that the application would be inadmissible. I think that at this stage we can all agree that this should not be the case, because there is absolutely no way that you as a private party can oblige a national court to make a reference. This is up to the national court to do so. So therefore, we cannot basically blame the individual of not exhausting a remedy which was not directly available to it. However, the ECJ has decided that in such cases where actually the question was raised and resolved by the national courts without any implication of the ECJ in the matter, it is very much recommendable that the ECJ be involved before the court in Strasbourg has to rule on the question. In a very unusual maneuver, the European Court of Justice published a so-called discussion document, it is available on the website, in which it does reach the conclusion that the ECJ should be involved in the matter. And therefore, we can find already in the draft agreement, Article 3, Paragraph 6, that the prior involvement of the ECJ is provided under this article. However, the interesting thing is that the drafters so far have abstained from specifying under what procedure precisely the ECJ would have to rule on the question. Apparently, the idea is that this is a very delicate question and it should be left to the internal EU legal order. How will this be done? One possibility is by a council decision. That's what I've read somewhere. This is feasible only as long as this council decision apparently does not breach or does not modify EU primary law. The latest suggestion that I have heard is about the possibility of the European Commission bringing the case in front of the ECJ. So basically, you have a complaint pending in front of the Strasbourg court. This complaint is notified to the EU. The representative of the EU would always be the European Commission. And therefore, the European Commission says, hold on, let's suspend the case in Strasbourg and let me bring the case in front of the ECJ. My question, however, and I don't have an answer to that, is under what procedure the European Commission can do that? Because as we know, an international agreement or even EU secondary law cannot in any way modify the existing primary law. One very interesting idea that has so far been circulated in academic writing is that the Commission can take the case to the ECJ under Article 263. This is the action for annulment. In other cases, for example, you have a regulation which it is argued is in breach of the ECHR. In that case, the Commission will bring a case under Article 263, arguing that this regulation is invalid. The obvious problem, there are at least two problems here. The obvious problem is that we have very strict time limits under Article 263. There is a two-month time limit, which will in any case be over by the time the case reaches Strasbourg. This is more than obvious. Now, there are suggestions that this time limit is actually not binding in a way. This is a very interesting argument. I find it very far-reaching because actually the validity of an EU act can be challenged also under the preliminary ruling procedure indirectly. And as we know, in that case, there are no time limits. However, we also know that if under constant case law, if the action for annulment was open for an individual or for an institution, then this individual or institution cannot challenge the act under the preliminary ruling procedure anymore. And last but not least, imagine actually the question was of the compatibility with convention rights of an act of the European Commission. Now, in this case, you would have the European Commission challenging its own act in front of the ECJ. I see that our time is almost over, so I promise that I should be able to come up with a solution to at least some of those queries. Regarding in particular the EU area of freedom, security, and justice. And we saw that there's a, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, there's a serious problem there. In order to try to preserve this EU area of freedom, security, and justice from crumbling, from disintegrating, I personally think that we should seriously discuss the idea of inserting in the future draft agreement some sort of a disconnection clause. Disconnection clauses are widely used, in particular in conventions of the Council of Europe. And according, there are different types of disconnection clauses, but according to this, to the classical type of disconnection clause, this basically means that in between, among EU member states apply EU law and not the convention. Now, in order for this disconnection clause to be not to be far-reaching, we can certainly think of limiting its scope only to cases where the requested member state recognizes or enforces a judgment or extrajudicial decision given by another member state. In other words, just like a case in Campanella versus Italy, the member state which initially was responsible for giving the judgment as to the substance of the case remains responsible for its acts under the convention and for eventual breaches of convention rights. However, we, in my opinion, should not extend this responsibility to the EU member state where recognition and enforcement is sought, because otherwise, as I said, we have, in my opinion, a serious risk of calling into question the very foundations of the EU area of freedom, security, and justice. Thank you very much for your attention. I think we still have some time for questions.